Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Today a very unusual program in that we're going to talk about a lot of different topics, of course starting with the latest on health and healing. For example, from Louisiana State University, an article on nutrients that can protect against HPV, human papillomavirus. That's important when you consider that probably 90% of the population has had it. And 80-90% of people get it. It's harmless. Your body clears it in a year or two. But some people can't. And a certain type of HPV can lead to genital warts or cancer. Those cancers are the vagina, the penis, the vulva, the cervix, the anus, and oral cancers of the throat and tongue. So what can we do about that? Good news. And I'm going to share that with you, the nutrients in this study that were shown to help eliminate that. Also from the University of Michigan, 1 in 5 parents say kids eat fast foods more often since the pandemic. Well, they were already eating a lot of fast foods. That's not good. We'll talk about that. And how rosemary essential oil can improve memory by 75% from Northumbria University in the United Kingdom. That's just one single thing. Also from the University of Bonn, which of course is in Germany, and the University of Haifa, which is in Israel, a lack of trust exacerbates loneliness and puts you into a negative spiral. Okay, what are the consequences? And also, socializing gives older adults, meaning over the age of 40, a cognitive boost, Penn State University. So we have a lot to share on health and healing as we do every day. But then a commentary today. I'm going to share a commentary that I think is important from a person who I respect. And it's going to be about fighting disinformation. The title of the article is "We've Got to Fight Disinformation," says Empire Made Entirely of Disinformation, by Caitlin Johnstone. Then I'm going to share, if time permits, my own, which is, how do you understand where the truth is when virtually all the media lies and then censors the truth? Also today, of all the different people speaking out about what's wrong with the existing paradigm, probably no one has said more that is insightful and accurate than a 40-year scientist, top scientist. We're talking about a world-class scientist. So important, he worked 17 years at Pfizer as a chief scientist, and he is pro-vaccine. He's been a part of vaccine programs, development, and drugs. So he's the ultra-orthodox scientist. Outstanding academic credentials. In fact, I edited out about 3 minutes of him talking about his own scientific background because of time restraints. His name is Michael Yeadon, Y-E-A-D-O-N. And he says the final, quote, "A final warning to humanity." Well, it is powerful what he says. Now, everything that he says, we have independently verified. So why don't we see him brought before Congress or debated? Take the best, take Anthony Fauci or take any of the other pro-vaccine people and debate him. Well, the same reason you don't debate Chris Hedges, because you're going to lose. This guy is getting his reputation trashed because he is challenging them. And the ultra-Orthodox scientists don't like to be challenged. But he's not alone. He's joined by about 100,000 others in the world. None of these voices are reaching the average American. None. The founder of Pacifica, Lou Hill, said that he founded this to be a voice for the voiceless. And indeed, over the years, over the decades, many of the programs have been that, fewer today, but there are still voices today within the foundation that act as a foundation to allow people who would challenge a different points of view on. We are that one of those programs. You'll hear that today. Also, you're going to hear a short 30-second clip before we go to health and nutrition. It's just 30 seconds. This is the top Oxford vaccine scientist who leads the whole committee. He is one of the most respected scientists in the world. It's only 30 seconds long. Now, I'm going to let you think and then call in later about what he's saying in 30 seconds. So it's not me quoting him out of his own words. You can watch him. Go to prn.fm, scroll down, and you can see every video I'm screening. And I always have all the notes there. So if someone says, well, Gary, what's the background on that? I have the scientific studies, the actual studies. It's not conjecture. It's not hearsay. Hard proof. He's going to tell you there is no herd immunity from the vaccines. What? But we were told the whole purpose, Anthony Fauci repeatedly, if we get 60% of the people, you know, vaccinated with the two vaccines, we'll have herd immunity. Well, then it became 65, then it was 70, then 75, then 80. And when confronted on this, he said, well, I didn't tell you the action because I didn't know if people could really handle it or understand it. Nonsense. So this man, who is one of the most knowledgeable in the world on this and heads the committee on this, says there is no capacity. It's not possible to get herd immunity with vaccines. Well, how would you? Natural immunity. Oh, but hold on. That protects you far greater than vaccines. So why would you not promote natural immunity, especially in healthy people? I could certainly understand if you wanted to isolate those individuals and treat them separately, vaccinate them if you choose, and they have all the knowledge of the side effects, including overstimulating the immune system. People already have a overstimulated immune system, which scientifically makes no sense at all. There is no science in that. But I'm simply saying, if that's what you choose, that's your freedom of choice. But wouldn't it make sense to understand that this virus and all of its different variants are going to be with us forever? And therefore, just like the flu every year, shouldn't we learn how to deal with it by prevention, using the peer-reviewed scientific literature that is on PubMed, Library of Medicine, to fortify our bodies, to have national programs of prevention, and then to look at all of the drugs FDA approved. I'm not even talking about alternative treatments, all the mainstream that are in PubMed. Ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, they were attacked. Yet they're the ones that have saved the most lives. So you're going to hear something today from another person who is being given testimony. And this person is giving testimony about how they have been lied to because he had done the research to show that the only drug that was promoted when people originally went in to get treated for COVID and still is promoted had no science behind it. In fact, the science that did exist, and you can see it for yourself, and we're going to show it to you today, the actual science, the actual studies, the actual manufacturer statements, is that it had to be withdrawn because it was killing so many people. They couldn't even finish the trial. And that's the one Anthony Fauci's promoting. What's his conflict of interest? Anyone in the media interested? It's there. I'm not going to tell you what it is today. You find it for yourself. Time people start to do some homework. That's our program. So we begin always with the latest on health and healing. Now, sexually transmitted diseases can be treated, and if you're using proper protection, can be prevented in most cases. But one of the reasons that we have the human papillomavirus vaccine, which is a complete and total fraud, and I've done a documentary on it, I've done many articles on it, you can go to GaryNall.com, see them for yourself, is that up to 90% of the people who contract human papillomavirus, for them it's harmless, and your body self-cleanses. So if you're using a pap smear, which you should be, and you're also being preventative, that's a lot of protection. The vaccine does not confer that protection, because there's dozens of different human papillomavirus that don't confer cervical protection based upon a mathematical model that in 50 years now, 40 years from now, you won't get cervical cancer. It is complete speculation, but it's killed an awful lot of young women, and it's injured tens of thousands more permanently. But the media won't touch that, won't look at it, won't interview the young athletic 17-year-olds who took it and now are in wheelchairs. So much for the media. In any case, what we now have is some nutrients that they say will make a difference. All right? And by the way, there's usually no outward sign or symptoms of human papilloma infection, nor is there any treatment to get rid of the virus, except in the orthodox model. In the alternative model, there is, with ozone and other things. By the way, that's why the regular pap smears and genital exams are so important. Caught early, precancerous lesions are treatable, and there are no similar oral screenings for infection. But then some scientists came along from Louisiana State University Health Science Center, and they found that something works. What? Vitamin A, vitamin B2, vitamin E, and folate, as well as a blood protein albumin. Quote, it is affected by the protein intake, the protein we eat. So foods with protein, nuts, eggs, dairy, meats, along with fruits and vegetables and multiple vitamins may help. It may be that those good dietary choices make your immune system better able to get rid of the virus. So what he's saying is, the healthier you are, the healthier system is, and I would add L-lysine, quercetin, and vitamin C, the big three, are antiviral for all viruses. They help your body immensely. So that's just more information. For some families, pandemic times have meant increased screen time, attending class from bedrooms, and maybe even more dinners from a drive-thru. And while many parents say their family has eaten healthier since the start of the pandemic, which is good, one in five report that children are eating more fast foods than ever before, and that's not good. This is according to University of Michigan's Health Center. So what has happened is the pandemic has disrupted many family routines, including where and what people eat. And remember when you couldn't go outside? So a lot of people took that so seriously, they wouldn't even go to farmers markets. In fact, some farmers markets would be shut down. And a lot of health food stores shut down. A lot of things. And a lot of health food stores ran out of food. You just couldn't get any food. Placed an order. And I just placed an order. And 50% of things I ordered for our anti-aging clinical study didn't come. So I had to search for all other, I got everything in the end, but I had to go to multiple places. And this is ongoing constantly. I'll do a program on what's happening to our food supply and why you should be very concerned what you can do about it on an upcoming program. Anyhow, so what is happening is this. Young people love the taste of fast food. They don't have to prepare it. Pizzas, hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, etc. All that is dangerous. It is creating an epidemic of disease in our children, which means they're going to have a shorter lifespan and a more painful lifespan. They're going to have obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and cancers at a much, much younger age. So what we have right now is that many of the children now will not outlive their parents. Think about that. All right? That's within our control. So we're going to have to put some energy into that. I'll give you some suggestions, and I'm sure many of you have had suggestions that we'll be happy to listen to about what we can do to bring back healthy habits to the individuals. And also from Northumbria University, I mentioned that rosemary. Now, rosemary, if you've ever eaten out in most restaurants, if you get a potato that has been roasted potatoes, it's generally some salt, pepper, and rosemary. Well, rosemary can be used in a lot of dishes. I happen to like rosemary, and I use rosemary as one of the condiments in when I make a seaweed salad. I also like to spice it up. I put a little bit of paste in there, a mustard paste, and diced olives, and I also use diced pickles. And suddenly the whole mouthfeel of the salad comes alive. Wasabi is good. It'll get your mouth a whole different mouthfeel when you have a salad with it. But rosemary is also not used enough. And here's one way it's never used. And yet here's a British research study found that just sniffing the essential oil of rosemary improved memory by an astounding 75%. That means it can be used to treat memory problems. That's a big deal. All right? Something that easy. Now, since a lot of people are wearing masks, just put two drops of rosemary on your mask. Put it on your pillow. Put it in a little dispenser, a little thing, that little tiny unit that you put essential oil in upside down, or it depends upon the dispenser, and then it vaporizes. And so if you really have dementia, you want it on all the time. So that's big, all right? Scent your room with rosemary, and you can see between a 60 to 75% better improvement in assorted memory tasks. And on performance like simple arithmetic structure, how you put together numbers, it improves it. Researchers took blood samples to detect levels of 1,8-cinnolyl, the constituent in rosemary, linked to improving memory function, and it's something brand new. And this was presented at the British Psychological Society annual conference to all the participants and published in the International Journal of Neuroscience. Something that simple. And finally, a lack of trust and loneliness. There's an association. Now, we all know that loneliness is a painful feeling. If it persists, it can lead to mental illness and depression and anxiety disorders. And this was done at several universities, Haifa University in Israel, the University of Bonn. And they wanted to see what is the connection between how loneliness is associated with the reduced trust. And this is reflected in changes in the activity and interactions of various brain structures, especially the insular cortex. The results, therefore, provide clues for therapeutic options. This was published in the Journal of Advanced Science. Everyone in this audience knows that what loneliness feels like, because we've all gone through periods of loneliness. Behind this feeling is the perceived discrepancy of the need for social relationships not being met to the desired degree. As with hunger that wants to be satiated, feelings of loneliness can also provide the motivation to connect with other people. However, some people are affected by persistent loneliness. Such cases can increase the risk of developing a mental illness or ending up with depression or anxiety disorders. And so people need to know that if they are in a relationship of any kind, that they can trust the person or persons in that relationship. And if they can, that frees them up from that angst, because a lack of trust creates anxiety. Anxiety gives you a sense of foreboding and a sense of loss. And therefore, I did this lecture last night, by the way. Look at everything you need to change in your life that you haven't up to this point that needs now. This is the time to change it. And without feeling angst, look at the positive lesson in a negative experience. Don't look at something as negative as all bad. There's always something to learn. And learning that trust should be there, providing that the other person or persons have shown that they deserve our trust. And that's always a good feeling when you have people in your life that you can trust. And you trust them, it's mutual. It gives you a completely different sense of peace of mind. And that then negates that sense of loneliness. I'm Gary, and all that's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a commentary. But first, we're going to play this short piece, listen carefully, one of the world's leading experts on vaccines and public policy. Listen exactly what he is saying so you know that he's contradicting everything, every single thing that we've been told about why to get the vaccine. We need to get the vaccine. We all got to get the vaccine. 70% of Americans got to get the vaccine. Here's what he has to say.
Where herd immunity is not a possibility because it still infects vaccinated individuals. And I suspect that what the virus will throw up next is a variant which is perhaps even better at transmitting in vaccinated populations. And so that's an even more of a reason not to be making a vaccine program around herd immunity. I don't think there's anything the UK can do to stop the emergence of new variants. They're going to happen. And if anything, we need to focus now not on what might stop new variants, because I don't think we have any facility to control that. We need to focus on thinking about how do we prevent people dying or going to hospital. And I think this is an enormously important thing to be thinking about today, because this during the course of this week will be about 65,000 deaths in the world. We have now over 4 billion doses deployed of the vaccine.
Okay, you heard what he said, his words. He's not alone. Shouldn't we be spending time looking at who is most vulnerable, what can be done now and early on to help those individuals, and what can we do to healthy individuals to prevent them from getting sick, build their immune system? We're not doing a single thing, and we haven't, and that's intentional. We have too much outstanding science on the immune system to show the difference. And we have thousands of examples of people who were healthy and met a virus and didn't die, and people who were not healthy met a virus and had comorbidity factors and died. None of that's being done. This is all manipulated. We have so much misinformation. The mainstream media is a part of it on everything. Just think of it this way. I'm going to be sharing tomorrow information from Covert Action Quarterly on the truth about Afghanistan, that everyone involved knew that it was unwinnable, but everyone was making a profit from it. Also, another example, one of the best investigative magazines in America that you all should be reading is, and not Time Magazine, some of these others, is Covert Action Quarterly, talking about Syria. The Obama administration demonized Syria and allowed us then to support terrorist groups in Syria. Yes. And Covert Action Quarterly covered it. No other mainstream media covered it. They did just the opposite. They tried to demonize and then say they were bad and deserved to be invaded. They did the same thing with Gaddafi. So the idea is that we are now looking at this administration tasking itself with the censorship of disinformation on social media. And as a result, the United States, in fact, is the hub of a global spanning empire that is built upon a foundation of disinformation, maintained by disinformation and facilitated by disinformation. This is according to Caitlin Johnstone. What does this mean? It means that if the propaganda engine of the United States centralized empire ceased actively deceiving the public about the world, it would collapse immediately. There would be mass unrest at home and abroad. Status quo politics would be abandoned. Alliances and coalitions would crumble. Leaders official and unofficial, would be ousted. The U.S. Unipol hegemony would end. The only thing keeping this from happening is the vast amount of wealth and energy which are poured into continuously deceiving the people of America and its allies about what's really going on in their nations and political systems in the world as a whole. Getting people believing they live in separate, sovereign nations which function independently from one another instead of member states within a single undeclared empire which moves as one unit on the international stage. Getting people believing they control the fate of their nation via the democratic process when in reality all large-scale politics are scripted puppet shows controlled by a plutocratic class who owns both the politicians and the media outlets which report on them. Getting people believing they are part of a virtuous, rules-based international order which opposes totalitarian regimes to spread freedom and democracy instead of a tyrannical empire that works to destroy any nation which disobeys its dictates. And above all, manufacturing the illusion that the oppressive, exploitive, imperialist status quo is normal. It's not the big, famous lies like those which preceded the invasion of Iraq that make up the bulk of the adhesive holding the empire together. It's the small, mundane lies which were fed every single day by the plutocratic media, the ones which distort our worldview by half-truths and spins and omissions designed to normalize the status quo of murder, theft, and ecocide. This normalization happens in the way pundits and politicians treat any attempt to end wars or redress income inequality as freakish extremism and unrealistic fantasy, which in reality is the most sane and normal thing in the world, and the only thing unrealistic about it is the fact that attempts to advance those agendas are always sabotaged by those same pundits and politicians. The normalization also happens in the way endless wars, starvation deaths by U.S. sanctions, the looming threat of total extinction via climate collapse or nuclear war, a rapidly accelerating income inequality and increased tyranny at home and abroad are not treated as newsworthy stories. While celebrity gossip, partisan bickering between OAC and Marjorie Taylor Greene makes headlines news, every day the news media fail to report on the greatest horrors that the empire has unleashed on our world while focusing on vapid trivialities they help normalize. If the mass media actually existed to share important information about the world, the U.S.-backed genocide in Yemen would be front-page news every day instead of something which gets marginal mention once. Every day, it isn't this outrageous abuse is normalized. If the mass media actually existed to share important information about the world, the fact that Americans are getting poorer and poorer while billionaires multiply their wealth during the pandemic would be brought front and center to everyone's attention. Every day, it isn't this outrageous abuse is normalized. If the mass media actually existed to share important information about the world, the fact that the U.S. military just spent trillions of dollars on a decades-long occupation of Afghanistan that accomplished nothing besides making horrible people rich would have been a national scandal. Every day it isn't, this outrageous abuse is normalized. But the mass media does not exist to share important information about the world. They exist to share important disinformation about the world. If they did not do this, the same U.S. empire, which is decrying the spread of disinformation today, would collapse in its own footprint. The U.S. empire is without exception the single most corrupt, destructive force on the planet, and it's not even close. It is the very last institution on earth that should be in charge of deciding what online content is true and what is disinformation. absolute dead last, without exaggeration, depraved institutions which lie constantly and have killed millions and displaced tens of millions just since the turn of the century should not be the ministry of truth for the world online communication system. This should be extremely obvious to everyone. But it isn't. And that's unfortunate. Let me give you one example. It was absolute law, now enforced by every single state medical board, that you cannot use ivermectin and you cannot use hydroxychloroquine or any of the other FDA-approved drugs to treat anyone at any stage of COVID. You can use remdesivir, but that's only because Anthony Fauci says you must use it. It's safe and effective. That is a lie, absolute lie. In fact, any independent investigation would show that one of the primary causes of death is this very drug. And all the doctors using it should have known better. They should have done some homework. The nurses, too. They're capable of getting on the internet and looking at a study and seeing the results of the study. They chose not to do this. Therefore, they're complicit. I separate out the person's intent to save lives and the results of how few, if any, they did. And this is one of the reasons you're going to now see and hear a person who did the homework. And here's what he has to say. And he's got all the evidence and all the charts. And you can actually see the charts for yourself. They're not hidden. That we shouldn't be using this drug at all, ever. It should never have been allowed. And yet the drugs that should have been allowed have been banned. And the media has been complicit. Here we go.
Website, what the treatment protocol for COVID-19 hospitalized patients was going to be. I was just curious because I heard in the media that within the third day, these New York doctors that were being flooded with COVID-19 patients, they were reporting by the day three and day five, they were experiencing what they had never seen before from a viral infection. They all reported that there was acute kidney failure within 3 to 4 days of treatment. And they have never seen, this was their words, we've never seen a virus do this to the kidneys. Well, the truth is, it's because the virus has never done that to the kidneys, and it was never the kidneys anyway. So when I heard this in the media, I wanted to know, well, what are they doing to these patients? Just 3 months earlier, my father-in-law was killed by medical protocols in a Dallas, Texas hospital. They literally used vancomycin, which is an antibiotic. It shut down his kidneys within 24 hours. By day three, they told us he was an acute kidney failure. By day five, he had so much water retention on his brain, he was going unconscious. By day nine, they had killed him. Now, vancomycin, the antibiotic, has a known side effect of acute kidney failure. And I don't know if anybody in here knows this, but they had diagnosed him with the flu in early February. Now, why would you ever use an antibiotic to treat a viral infection? It's not conducive. It's not safe or effective. The CDC actually warns against it. But vancomycin has acute kidney failure as a side effect. Well, when I actually, you let me know when you're ready to translate. I don't want to get too far ahead. Yeah. But you let me know when you want me to stop.
Hold on one second, because there's, I don't know if you're aware of this, but our chief medical advisor, I guess we can call him, he's the one who really got this corona committee started. Dr. Vodak is with us. So he may ask some questions, which we can't ask because we're no experts. We're only lawyers. We're always dependent on people like you and Dr. Vodak and the others. So that killed your father-in-law, and that's what got your attention when you heard that they're using remdesivir in New York, right?
Yeah, what got my attention was the New York doctors were reporting, when we're treating this new coronavirus, we're seeing that within 3 to 5 days, we're seeing acute kidney failure.
Yeah.
Because the virus, we assume, is attacking the kidneys,
yeah.
Which I knew right away that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. So I actually wanted to know, are they using vancomycin on these people also? Because uh-huh. This is a virus just like the flu. So I went on to CDC's website to find out what are they actually treating COVID patients with. And the CDC refers you to the National Institutes of Health website for the treatment protocol of COVID-19. And this is when the storm happened for me. Mm-hmm. When I opened the website, Anthony Fauci was declaring that there's this new drug that is mandated in all hospitals and used by all medical doctors in America called Remdesivir, and it is the only treatment to be used in all hospitals in America.
Whoa.
And then it said you cannot use hydroxychloroquine. It's proven to be dangerous for COVID-19 patients, and you can't use chloroquine. Now, I have reviewed drugs that patients have been on for the last 20 years. I had never heard of Remdesivir. So I went to the FDA's website to find out any information about Remdesivir, only to find out Remdesivir was never FDA approved to be safe or efficacious for any disease. But on the NIH's website, Anthony Fauci said, every doctor in the country has to use Remdesivir only. And there's these two research studies that prove Remdesivir is efficacious and warranted during this novel coronavirus. The first study quoted on the website was the Ebola trials on four experimental drugs in 2018. And then there was a second study, which was a study, it's called a cohort study, which was actually sponsored by Gilead, the manufacturer of Remdesivir, in March 2020. And they had 53 COVID-19 patients from three countries, Japan, Canada, and America, that they gave Remdesivir for 28 days. Now, there was two links on the National Institutes of Health website that Anthony Fauci was quoting. All I did was click the first one. I wanted to see this research study on the Ebola virus that warranted now Fauci saying, we're going to use this non-FDA approved drug because of this research study on Ebola. When I clicked the link, and anyone can go to it now, in that study, there was four drugs, Remdesivir and National Institutes of Health experimental drug that Fauci put in, not Remdesivir, but a second one, and then two other experimental antibodies. In the study, at 6 months of this one-year study, the safety board for the study found Remdesivir had the highest death rate of all four experimental drugs and pulled the drug from the study. It didn't even make it to the end of the study because it was so deadly. They also pulled Anthony Fauci's experimental drug he put in the trial because it was the second most deadly. So did Anthony Fauci know about Remdesivir's death? Oh, you better believe it. And now he was going to push this on the masses? Well, the second study that he quoted on NIH's website, which was the cohort study by Gilead, it actually published its findings within 28 days of giving these 53 COVID-19 patients from three countries. They figured out what the side effects were. 22% of all 53 patients that had COVID-19 experienced these four lethal side effects: multiple organ failure, acute kidney failure, septic shock, and hypotension. 8% of them had to be taken off the drug on day 5 or 10 because they were dying from the poison of the drug's effects on multiple organs. So 30% of these individuals experienced four life-threatening side effects of the drugs. Now, acute kidney failure was the one that caught my attention. What were the medical doctors in New York saying in the media? We've never seen a virus do this before, but when we start treatment, we're seeing a virus attack the kidneys and cause acute kidney failure. Not only in New York are we struggling to find ventilators, we don't have enough dialysis machines. Well, I knew right away it was Remdesivir poisoning. Anthony Fauci knew it was deadly because the actual research study he was quoting, I could not believe that no one clicked the link to go look at the study to see, well, what were the results of the study with Remdesivir on Ebola virus patients that warrants now Fauci saying you got to give it to coronavirus patients. Anyway, it was disgusting. And immediately I had to contact the media and actually tell the world.
But nobody wanted to hear There was no news on this, no discussion, no debate. That could have saved a lot of lives. And all the drugs that Anthony Fauci insisted and the media parroted should not be used. We have presented hundreds upon hundreds of studies showing they work and save lives. It is estimated that upwards of 80% of the people could be alive today had they been given these drugs early on, even those who went to hospital. So this is what you're dealing with. But I want to play a clip now from this scientist who is taking on the protocols. Mind you, I'm not going to go into his background. By the way, this gentleman was Dr. Brian Ardis, A-R-D-I-S. But now we're going to hear from this doctor, this scientist, and listen carefully. You can agree or disagree, but I'm saying if you disagree, debate him. Show where he's wrong. Bring him to the New York Times for a roundtable. Have a webinar with him and challenge him. They're not doing that. Wonder why. Here's Dr. Yeadon.
You would expect from that I am pro new medicines of all kind. Our goals always were to address unmet medical need and to do so with acceptable safety given the medical context. And I'm in favour of all modes of new medical treatments, whether they're biologicals or vaccines, small molecules, creams, sprays, ointments, whatever. But I'm fervently against unsafe medicines or medicines used in an inappropriate context. And so some of the things I'm going to say are not favourable to the current crop of gene-based vaccines, and it's for that reason that they're being inappropriately used, and I don't think they have a sufficient safety profile to be used as a sort of wide-spectrum public health prophylactic. As a result of that background in pharmaceutical industry and biotechnology, I am pro new medical entities that treat unmet need and do so safely. And that's true whether the entity is a vaccine or a biological, like an antibody, or if it's what I would call a small molecule therapeutic, you know, a pill or a tablet. But I'm anti-unsafe medicines, regardless of what format they are. And so my criticisms sometimes fall onto unsafe small molecule substances and sometimes on unsafe vaccines. So I'm generally pro new medicines, as long as they are safe and effective and used appropriately, and I'm anti the opposite of those things. A few things have allowed me, I think, to spot what's going on in the world at the moment. I do have, I would say, two big advantages. One, I've loved biology since I was little, and this year marks the 40th year I've been studying, continuing to learn and to apply biology broadly, whether it's pharmacology, biochemistry, molecular biology, toxicology. And so I've got a very broad grounding in all things to do with life science in terms of health and disease. But one of my former supervisors said that I had a remarkable facility that stood out above the sort of ordinary things you'd have to do to be a vice president or a CEO. And he said that I was able to spot patterns in sparse data earlier than my peers did. So when there was not enough data for most people to judge what was going on, I would often be able to see it. I could see a pattern forming when there wasn't quite enough information. And really, I guess I was running a lot of simulations in my head and trying to work out what could these small bits of information mean, rather than waiting for more data. It's my word, I think I know what's happening here. And that would sometimes be applied to, say, target selection in industry, or how we should prosecute a program, or what the competition was doing. But on this occasion, it allowed me quite quickly to work out that what we were being told about this virus and what we needed to do in order to stay safe was simply not true. For example, early on in the UK, there were enormous changes made in attribution of causes of death. So we'd never had anything as absurd as the rule that is now used. So if you should die within 28 days of having a positive result in an inappropriate test using molecular biology, then you would be declared to have died of COVID-19. That's just wrong. It's not just a matter of disagreeing professionally. It's just complete nonsense. And we can certainly talk about the unreliability, untrustworthy nature of PCR testing, but also things like lockdown. I mean, just the whole phrase of it, the fact that it was completely unprecedented, and that we basically were to minimize contact one with another, and that that was going to save us. I knew quite early on that that was rubbish, and the reason is simple, that only people who are ill and have symptoms are really strong infectious risks to other people. And those people are not people who are walking around in the community, because if you're full of virus and symptomatic, you are also ill. And ill people tend to stay at home or in bed, and or if they're very serious, they end up in hospital or die. And so the idea that if you cut normal contacts at work and, you know, just civic society and your normal economy, that that would slow epidemic spreading, I was fairly sure fairly on that that was bunk. And unfortunately, it took several months before that was clear, by which time the idea that lockdown is what you need to do had been pretty much cemented in most of the world. So basically, everything your government has told you about this virus, everything you need to do to stay safe, is a lie, every part of it. And I'll be challenged on that. Literally, there are none of the key themes that you hear talked about, from asymptomatic transmission to top-up vaccines, not one of those things is supported by the science. Every piece is a cleverly chosen adjacency to something that probably is true but is itself a lie, and has led people to where I believe we are right now. And I don't normally use phrases like this, but I think we are standing at the very gates of hell. Yeah, when I first heard the phrase lockdown, for example, I hope, like most people, I thought this is a phrase you use in relation to controlling unruly prisoners. It's a control measure. And I think pretty much all that has happened since is to do with control. This myth of asymptomatic transmission, which is simply not true, as I mentioned earlier, in order to transmit a virus to be a good, efficient source of infection, you have to have a lot of virus. And if you have a lot of virus in you, the virus is attacking you and you are fighting back. That process produces symptoms inevitably. It's not just occasionally. It must always happen. And so all people who are very good sources of infection are ill. So the whole idea of asymptomatic transmission, I would think if it occurs at all, it's like 1% or 0.1%, as good as a strong infectious case. So by the time we got to about the third main theme of this pandemic and how to control it, I knew I was being lied to all the time by government, scientists, their advisors, by ministers, people on the TV. And I'm afraid that impression has simply firmed up as time's gone on. And so it's all about control. Obviously, I have my own thoughts about what that control is going to be used for. And
that's just the opening tomorrow, a 10-minute clip where he gets into, as a scientist, how he saw what was happening and how virtually everything being done and advised was wrong. You can agree or disagree, but we are going to be taking what we consider some of the most important arguments on this issue. Now I want to share some other information with you. A new story out today from Common Dreams, quote, more than 1.2 million Americans are currently displaced from their homes because of climate change impacts, including increasingly severe storms, wildfires, and flooding. The headlines in recent weeks, as we know, read like signs of an impending apocalypse. 16 years to the day since Hurricane Katrina slammed into New Orleans, the Louisiana coast was once again battered by Hurricane Ida, one of the strongest storms ever recorded in the state. Wildfires in California have blanketed the western U.S. with smoke, prompting mass evacuations. In New York, floodwaters poured into the subways and through the windows of basement apartments. People died. They drowned. And while scientists and journalists are quick to point out that no single disaster can be traced directly to climate change, one thing is clear. Storms, wildfires, floods, and related hazards are all becoming more frequent and severe as the planet warms. Australia just today is now reporting 50 degrees Celsius. Wow, that is hot you're talking about over 120 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's on top of having a plague of rats, hundreds of millions of rats. One house I saw a video of had hundreds of rats in it. With the rats come the poisonous snakes. And now you have, ready for this? There were over 7 million koala bears. Now there's 30,000. It's almost extinct. Nothing's been done to prevent anything. It's just, and now they have this totalitarian regime there. So the poor people living in Australia, and by the way, I have a lot of listeners right now in Australia listening. And I've worked, in fact, in helping the Greeks with the immigrants and providing the immigrants with a holistic, healthy nutrition program. That came from a husband and wife living in Australia to ask, would I help and go over there and do all this? And that happened. And we did what we could. In any case, and I said, you realize that that Australia is not sustainable. Now, well, maybe now they're saying that's the case. Worst fire last year in the country's history. So everywhere you look, you're finding this. Now, here's something interesting. A new statistic came out showing that the wealthiest people on the planet, and that includes the wealthiest people in America, and that includes all of our, well, not all, but the vast majority of our millionaires and billionaires and even professional class, their standard of living is so extensive. The homes they have, the private jets, all the cars they own, how much fuel they use, their carbon footprint represents almost 30% of all of the energy use against the rest of the population. So the average person uses little, and poor people use even less. So the wealthiest are the major human contributors to global warming. Yet you never hear anyone at Davos or the World Economic Forum or in the Great Reset, you never hear any discussion of how you who control everything are the cause of everything. You're to blame. Not a word. It's like it didn't exist. Just want to let you know that. So it's time now that we understood that part of the problem is those who are trying to control the problem, and they're not looking at real change. They're not out there planting billions of trees. They're not out there suggesting a plant-based diet. If we went to a plant-based diet, we could cut methane gases by at least 30% in the United States. They're not talking about real solutions. Everything is a euphemism for the future. They all sound like Barack Obama. Nothing gets done that's good because they're all corporatists. They all share some common beliefs in the uniqueness of themselves without abiding by what we all have to do together. There's no togetherness. Just want to share that. What are your thoughts? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Also want to mention now, as of today, we edited my 8-hour How to Survive COVID webinar. It was packed. I'm sorry, thousands of people wanted to come. We had no room. We had the widest WAMBIF we could get, but it's now posted on GaryNall.com. So now you can go to GaryNall.com and see now the webinar, How to Survive COVID. Also, when you're there, you can see the new premiere for the film dealing with the environment, Last Call for Tomorrow. It's there. You can download it. And it's in, I think it's October 16th, the Saturday at noon. I've got two of the world's greatest environmentalists on, Dr. Kruger from Canada, the woman who's the world's expert on trees, and also Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus Guy McPherson, who will be there. That's an extra 2 hours. It'll be a live discussion on that. You'll be able to watch the film, which is the most winning documentary in world history. I think we're approaching 300 at this moment. Official selections, finalists, and awards. That's never happened to any film. So it's getting a message out, but it's virtually non-existent in the media in the United States. So it's your chance to watch it and see what are the problems, because it's shot all over the world. Phenomenal cinematography. In fact, we've won awards in cinematography, best screenplay, best environmental film. So last call for tomorrow. Sign up for it because we have a limited bandwidth and it was packed the last time. It'll be packed this time. Thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Eutrice Lead. She's coming up right now.